Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, dragging you down into the abyss of the human mind once again to explore the fascinating yet terribly tragic case of Kanika Powell, a vicious murder which not only remains unsolved to this day, but also mostly forgotten because it's been baffling since day one, nearly devoid of evidence. Everywhere you turn in this case, there's a dead end. So let's put on our hard hats and dig down to the bedrock of behavioral analysis to understand the killer's choices. Okay, so on August 28th, 2008, at 11:50 a.m., 28-year-old Kanika Powell returned to her apartment in Prince George's County, Maryland, after running some errands and was shot multiple times in the chest and abdomen upon entering the hallway outside her door. The unknown assailant vanished in the aftermath, and while Kanika didn't succumb to the injuries immediately, she passed away the next day. On a side note, this murder occurred on the same day as the death of Brian Wells, who you might remember as the pizza delivery guy who exploded due to the collar bomb in the Netflix documentary Evil Genius. Anyway, now, there's very little evidence in this case, so what I want to do is profile the killers by way of desire, timing, and professional qualities such as planning, execution, and discretion. The level of skill and intelligence apparent in the crime should give us a better idea of who these people are and who masterminded it. So, as opposed to the last episode where I dissected the Keddie murders and the social implications inherent in that situation, we'll apply the same thing here and find we have a nearly polar opposite situation. Whereas Sue Sharp had 5 children and few options for career prospects, leaving her forced to raise her kids under conditions conducive to regular contact with men who indulge criminal activity, including violence and drug dealing, Kanika is going to be targeted under much different circumstances. We're not going to be able to point a finger and say, aha, that's the problem. In all honesty, we don't have a clue why she was targeted, or by whom. Kanika is a single woman in her 20s, independent, without children, and living alone while pursuing a serious career. The way she got to that point was by enlisting in the army after high school, hoping that might help to carve out her path in life. Of course, fields like security and law enforcement can be popular choices for people who have military experience, and Kanika ultimately goes that direction during her time stationed overseas in Korea. After returning home to Prince George's County, Maryland, she finds employment at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory as a security contractor. Of course, we know Kanika worked in the field of national security, and even in relation to homeland security, but the job is confidential, or classified, to an extent that we don't know exactly what her responsibilities entailed. Kanika was also very close with her mother, and when Mom would inquire about business trips her daughter took, Kanika made it clear she couldn't discuss those things. So, the first point I want to make about this job is that it's easy to rush to a conclusion that Kanika was murdered in relation to her profession, either because she saw something she shouldn't have seen, or was about to, or even learned a coworker was abusing power in some way. Those things could have happened, but what we have in front of us is a case with very little evidence, and so I believe the best we can do is dig deep into the psychology from all aspects and see what we come up with at the end in terms of what we can verify in the pursuit of truth. So, there were apparently hundreds of projects going on at any one time in the lab where Kanika worked, and as anyone working in security would probably tell you, even areas involving clearance, not everything that's classified, secret, or even just handled in a discreet manner is constructed of mind-blowing, world-changing properties conducive to mass conspiracy. It's still a workplace, with humans, and all sorts of mundane things happen to make the world go round. In that light, looking at Kanika's age of 28 and experience of 4 years with the company, along with her status as a contractor the first 2 years, it doesn't seem likely to me that she was bestowed with the type of information that would require killing her if she learned of its content. Is that possible? Definitely. But we're going to see behavior from the killer, or killers, that isn't consistent with the technological capabilities of detection that the government has. She doesn't seem to be under surveillance away from her apartment, nor is her death remotely discreet. If you have ample resources, like the government, you can come up with any number of ways to kill a single woman during the routine of her daily life, obviously because a single status means she likely travels alone on a regular basis. You don't need to worry about her kids being in the minivan or her boyfriend showing up and thwarting the attempt at her life while being able to identify you. Discretion is fairly simple to achieve. A parking garage without cameras, an ambush at night when she's getting in or out of her car in any dark parking lot, jogging or walking alone, following her in a car at night and shooting her when she stops at a traffic light or train crossing. If you have resources to track someone's moves, these things become much easier. But if you don't have ample resources and can't indulge sufficient amounts of detection to pull off the task of tracking and ambushing someone in a discreet manner, meaning a low-risk circumstance, it's going to be obvious in the results. The assailant in this case proves to have very little knowledge about Kanika Powell beyond her name and address. He doesn't utilize other aspects of her life to find vulnerability. Everything happens at home, in daylight, and subject to witnesses. So, what we have here is a high-risk criminal, likely a sociopath, or multiple people with the same antisocial goals regarding criminal activity. With that knowledge, let's check out how the tragic event materializes. Now, one of the things that bothers me about this case, aside from the obvious loss of life, is that a narrative exists claiming that Kanika did everything right. If someone is trying to kill you, and you're ignorant of who it is, why they're doing it, or even what methods this person might employ, there simply isn't a way to definitively assign the right thing to do. Kanika is going to take multiple measures to protect herself and others, but also leave herself quite vulnerable due to certain factors. For instance, let's say I'm a maniac and I send you an anonymous message that I'm coming for you. Most of us don't have the immediate inclination, or often even the resources available, to just jump up and move if we're threatened. We call the police. We lock our doors. We might alert the neighbors, or get a dog. But what you can't do, in terms of an unknown enemy, is predict what will happen. If you're in the military, as Kanika was at one point, you can spend all day, all night, and all of your material and intellectual resources devising plans to accommodate things like this. You're in that business. But if you're at home living what is essentially a civilian life, despite your status as a government worker, your options for dealing with the circumstance will be conducive to societal measures. Kanika can't conceal herself behind a barricade in her apartment all day. She has to go to work, have friends, hang out with her mom, maintain her car, and whatever else she does in her free time. So, as a woman, when you're being threatened like this by a man, and are vulnerable to attack, it's hard to name any one action, or even a set of actions, as the right thing to do. No matter what you do, anything less than totally overreacting might get you killed. For instance, you could pick up and move instantly if you're being stalked, but that's not practical, nor is it something you should have to do. You shouldn't have to exist in a constant state of terror. But in the same way Kanika doesn't have the same resources available to her in civilian life as she did in the army, in terms of protection, the cops can't offer her that either. It's a common sentiment that the cops can just leave officers parked outside your home, or even in your home, as a means of protection, but for the most part, that's the province of Hollywood films. Do cops do that? Sure. But taking even one cop off the street for patrol in favor of sitting that person in a stagnant position outside one home is wasteful. Yes, it's invaluable for the person receiving the protection, but the effectiveness of a police force, at least to a certain extent, is predicated upon a decent ratio of civilians to cops. If you have two cops sitting at your house, and live in an urban or heavily suburban area like you might find in Prince George's County, Maryland, that means thousands of people in the local area don't have the benefit of their service. And if they do, it's because other officers are then being paid overtime. The point is that police are not a protection agency, despite their mission to protect. Crime fighting will always be far more responsive than it is proactive. Basically, the cops come once somebody pulls a gun, once there's a problem. That means their primary objective is to prevent, or limit, the fallout from the crime, thereby ensuring the overall safety of society rather than the individual. Kanika, having military experience, is going to approach this incident in a very selfless, proactive way, conducive to her training, but her adherence to teamwork and refusal to indulge individuality more appropriate to civilian life are, in some ways, going to get her killed. Of course, it's no fault of her own, and she does nothing wrong, but Kanika will treat this situation as though it's not happening in a societal setting. You can see her instincts for the battlefield mistakenly take hold of a social issue. So the evening of August 23rd, 2008 rolls around, and a man shows up at Kanika's door to kick off her nightmare. What I'm going to do first is read the email Kanika sent the following Monday 2 days later to a group of family and friends after this incident. From KTP131. Subject, weekend. I just wanted to share with you the scariest thing that happened to me this weekend. Saturday evening, around 7 p.m., a man was knocking at my door. As all of you may know, I live alone. I asked who it was and he didn't answer, so once I got close to the door and looked out of the peephole, I saw a male figure that was not familiar to me at all. I asked who he was, and all he stated was that he was from the FBI and that he was looking for Kanika Powell. It freaked me out completely because this man knew my name. He held up a shield, but no picture ID, and he never gave his name. He told me he was looking for me in regards to an investigation. I told him that I had no idea as to what he was talking about and that he would need to show me documentation as well as a warrant of some sort. So he left, and I looked out my bedroom window and saw him walking. I also heard a voice tell him to walk in the opposite direction. The whole situation was so scary and seemed so false. So, because of this incident, not only did I get no sleep for the rest of the weekend, but I am now trying to get an alarm system installed in my apartment. I had one in my old apartment, but just hadn't had it transferred over to my new one. As far as everything that happened with the guy, I did call the FBI, and they told me that it was more than likely bogus because they never come to your door by themselves, and they always leave a card of some sort so that you can contact them. I called the local police as well to give them a description just in case someone is out there trying to rape or harm single women. Pass this on, ladies. This is not a fake forward. This happened to me, Kanika. Who knows who these guys are and what they are doing and in what other areas than mine. End quote. Okay. The first thing to notice about this event is that it happens on a Saturday evening at 7 p.m. in late August, a time which would offer plentiful daylight, in addition to the potential for a lot of foot and car traffic entering the parking lot and building outside, as well as the interior hallways. People would likely be coming and going, not only in this building, but in neighboring buildings as well. People tend to be pretty active during the evening hours in summer, when things cool off a bit. A lot of people just hang out on their stoop, patio, porch, balcony, or whatever the case may be. During other times of the year, especially on the East Coast in Maryland, the cold weather would prevent this from happening. Now, in 2019, you pretty much assume anybody suspicious coming to your door unannounced is there to kill you, whether rational or not. But back in 2008, it was still somewhat common to go knocking for another person unannounced. What I mean is that it would be reasonable to think someone might just open the front door if you knock. Today, for the most part, we're more careful because we live insulated lives due to our technology. When people avoid the use of technology while trying to contact us in 2019, we're immediately suspicious. If they refuse to be detected on approach, their intentions are likely malicious. So, what we should expect to see in this situation, given that 2008 was a transitional technological period from the standpoint of diminishing in-person communication, is an attempt at contacting Kanika utilizing obsolete technology, causing evolution, in the form of her brain, to recognize that request as technologically regressive and thereby send the message to her intuitively that there's a problem here related to detection. The specific implication will be that malicious circumstances are at play, and that's because the act of manipulation has a direct correlation to withholding pertinent information related to safety. If you're ever in a situation with a suspicious man who's attempting to limit your technological capability in any way, he's planning to steal resources from you. It could be money, sex, your life, or all three. But the truth is that people with legitimate intentions will not try to prevent you from detecting their light source. For instance, if your neighbor is holding a knife, banging on your locked door, and screaming about how he's going to kill you, there's no manipulation involved. His actions are wholly genuine because he's not making an attempt at concealment. If you open the door, you will die. It's straightforward and simple. Intuition never comes into play in that circumstance, and technology has no bearing on the situation except to prove that a knife isn't sufficient technology for opening a locked door. But we already know that's true. So, when this perpetrator arrives at Kanika's door, his initial attempt to get inside is nothing more than a knock. We know this because her email states that he knocked, and she subsequently asked who was at the door, only to get no answer. That means he was hoping to get her to open the door without offering any information at all, which is the least technologically viable method of doing so. But he's attempting this because those long odds of success also mean that his risk is lowest at this point. It's not a crime to knock on someone's door, nor is it illegal to refuse to identify yourself. Now, these are behaviors that, when practiced repetitively, could get you in trouble with the police for harassing someone, but in terms of a single visit to Kanika's door, there's very little risk in knocking to hope she opens it. Now, while this is a smart move, it also dictates Plan B is not a good one. You're not confident in it, and that proves true here. The perpetrator knocks, hoping Kanika will just open the door to find out who he is. Of course, she counters his lack of identity by asking who is at the door. Now, we know she does this from across the room because she says she goes to the door after getting no response from him. So if she calls out, "Who is it?" from across the room, she's going to have to raise her voice for him to hear her. Now, obviously, she wants to know who this is, so she's going to release her words with sufficient volume for them to carry all the way to the door and then through it. In that light, what we know is that, in order to answer Kanika in a manner she can hear the response, the person outside the door will have to raise his voice as well. But he isn't standing inside her apartment. He's in the hallway. So if he announces who he is, in a volume suited to traveling to Kanika through the door, his voice is also going to penetrate the doors of nearby apartments to a somewhat lesser extent. That means the neighbors will be able to hear his answers. So, if he's from the FBI, and it's true, he can just announce that to her. If the police come to your door, and you ask who it is, they especially want to tell you because they need to speak with you. But this person at Kanika's door won't respond. And why? He knows two things. One is that she isn't going to open up, and the other is that she's even more curious now to know who it is. The obvious course of action for her is to get closer to the door and repeat the question. So Kanika does that. She goes to the door and asks. But by doing this, she falls right into the trap. He knows he can't respond to her question in a loud voice, claiming to be from the FBI, because that's a lie, and somebody else might hear it, so he waits for her to come to the door and ask again. What this means is that the volume of her voice will be significantly reduced due to proximity, and that same close proximity is now going to allow him to respond to her in a quieter voice. What this allows is for neither party to draw the attention of outside parties to the situation. For instance, if I'm a creep knocking on your door, and you call out to ask who I am, and I yell back that I'm an FBI agent, that could easily draw the interest of the neighbors. If it's true, that's great, but if I'm about to pull out a fake badge, I realize that it's a serious crime to impersonate an agent and could do time in prison without getting a chance to commit the crime I came to do. Which leads into the next point. If I came to commit a crime, which ultimately turns out to be your murder by way of a handgun, why wouldn't I just shoot you through the door when you looked out the peephole and refused to open? The end result is that Kanika is murdered. Nothing else transpires. No robbery, burglary, home invasion, rape, or anything else. A decent caliber handgun will shoot right through most wooden apartment doors, and with the fact being you have to put your eye, and therefore your face and head, right up against a peephole to look out, someone could shoot you point blank in the chest, or even in the head. You could even just unload the weapon through the door, knowing the person on the other side has to be in front of it to observe. But that doesn't happen. So if we look at the end result, which is nothing but Kanika's life being taken, as opposed to the killer's original intention of getting her to open the apartment door, there's an obvious inconsistency. If he's there to shoot her, the neighbors are going to hear it, whether he pulls the trigger in the hallway or in her apartment. In fact, if he does it in the hallway, he might even be able to exit the hallway before any of the neighbors can get to their door to look out their own peepholes. Moreover, that also gives him the best chance to get away outside without being seen. If people get scared by the gunshots and hesitate to look out their doors or windows, he might have an extra few seconds to escape while limiting his likelihood of being detected. Yet, instead of shooting her through the door, the man says he's from the FBI. However, he doesn't give a name or even offer ID. He just holds up a badge. What it says is that this man is stupid, and he's expecting the same of Kanika. She asked who he was, and he hasn't offered her a name or any identification. Both of those things are far more important than the badge, yet he believes the badge trumps everything because of its symbolic power. This is highly manipulative. She has asked a question based in specificity regarding an individual's identity, and in return, he offers a generalized association with a federal investigative agency. Lack of resources to prove something true instantly makes it a lie in terms of our perception. Without ID or even acknowledgement of it, this person is a total fraud. So we can see two things very clearly right from the start. One is that this isn't a hit. It's not just about killing Kanika. The man wants to gain access to the apartment. Otherwise, he could shoot her right through the door, point blank, and avoid any type of scuffle with her, leading to DNA transfer or involvement by neighbors. Of course, he could obviously just wait for her any day of the week to come outside, going to work, or getting out of her car to go back inside. It's the most reasonable thing to do if his plan is simply to kill Kanika. And if he's just there to shoot her to death, he certainly doesn't need any help, as proven by the end result of Kanika being shot and killed by one man with one gun in that same spot outside her door. Yet, she writes in her email that when the man left after she refused to let him in, he was directed by someone else hiding outside to walk the other way. So if there was another person hiding outdoors, of what value would he be in a hit? The answer is he wouldn't have any value. Now, what that means is that this is likely a home invasion with a plan for one guy to enter the apartment, get control of the victim, and then relay to the other guy by text or waving from a window that it's clear to finally come inside. He has to have purpose. If he's just the getaway driver, then he would stay in the car. Yet he's at the apartment building. Now, let's go back to the email Kanika sent. It references the man at her door being a male figure. That doesn't offer us anything about his identity other than to say he doesn't seem to have been disguised at the time. If he was, I think she would have mentioned it. All she gives us is that she doesn't recognize him. So on the surface, there doesn't seem to have been anything particular to note about him. In fact, when she goes on to tell us about the voice she heard instructing him outside, there's no mention of anything strange about that either. So, the reason I mention this is due to statistics. Approximately 13% of the U.S. population is considered black and/or African American, the distinction there being that there is certain ancestry traditionally considered black, but not necessarily of African descent geographically. Regardless, our focus here is specifically skin color, and the origin of it will be irrelevant for our purposes. In terms of what we need to know, Prince George's County in Maryland has a population that is nearly 63% black and/or African American, so when also factoring in the Asian, Latino, and mixed race demographics, what we learn is that only 17.7% of people living in that county are white. About 25 years ago, a group of black FBI agents sued their employer for matters regarding insufficient opportunities in relation to their white counterparts, making note of the fact only 1 in 20 agents was African American at the time. A judge sided with their claim and demanded change in the FBI. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, and the claims went back to court again, this time bringing in an arbitrator to handle future disputes. Even still, by 2014, numbers proved there was an even smaller percentage of black agents represented in the FBI workforce, going from 5.3% at the time of the lawsuit to 4.4% in 2014. From former FBI Director James Comey, while giving a speech at traditionally black university Bethune-Cookman in Florida, quote, "Slowly but steadily over the last decade or more, the percentage of special agents in the FBI who are white has been growing. I've got nothing against white people, especially tall, awkward male white people, but that is a crisis for reasons that you get, and that I've worked very hard to make sure the entire FBI understands," end quote. So, obviously, the FBI has a diversity issue. But let's take a look at what that means to us in the context of Kanika's murder. In social situations, people have traditionally talked about others in default mode regarding race. So, if I'm white, but have a diverse group of friends, while living in a predominantly white area, by default of statistics, most of those people are likely going to be white. And when I talk to them about other people they don't know, because we're white and living in that predominantly white area, I'm not going to mention a person is white while telling a story, because I know they'll already make that assumption in the absence of being instructed otherwise. We tend to mention someone's race when it's statistically improbable in a way that a person wouldn't be able to assume. So, let's just say I'm an African-American woman with an African-American family living in a predominantly African-American community where most of my friends would likely fit the bill as well, and a suspicious man I don't know comes to my door. I'm probably not going to specify that he's black. I'm going to specify in the event statistics betray your assumption. I grew up in Philly, which is incredibly diverse, specifically in terms of its white and black populations. When involved in any kind of activity where the group was almost entirely white, the non-white participants were far more often identified by race. Conversely, when I found myself the lone white guy in a group of African-American people, it was far more common for them to identify me as something like the white dude. It's not a racist endeavor. It's just that, like your shirt, your skin color is an easy way to point out who you are if you're different from the crowd. It's like when you see that guy in a group of people who looks like a redwood tree and you refer to him as the tall guy. You don't need to know his name in order to point him out to somebody else. You use that identifying characteristic. Now, of course, this can be insensitive on many levels and in different situations, but I think it's something that's commonly used anyhow. So what we should notice with Kanika is that, just by default of the statistics, there's only a 1 in 20 chance the man claiming to be an FBI agent would be black. But she never specifies his looks or his race in her email, and that email was specifically to warn people about the danger. So you'd want to include some distinguishing characteristics. But even though she's terrified, the only info she offers is that she didn't recognize him. She goes into default mode of saying it's a man, a male figure, but goes no further. Given that she is predisposed to more often engaging African-American people in her personal life, by way of her location and heritage, it stands to reason the most likely male identity she would consider lacking distinguishing characteristics is that of an African-American man. She lives in a community that's only 17.7% white. With the overwhelming majority of FBI agents being white, it says that the most likely result of an agent coming to her door is that the person would be racially different than her. That's the most probable situation. But we don't get any mention of his looks. Kanika might have felt it was important to tell the cops, but she doesn't tell her family and friends. With many of those family and friends sharing her racial makeup, it's probable she didn't mention race because the assailant was black. She specifically says she's concerned about other women and wants them to be aware, and the best way to make people aware is to tell them what he looks like. It never happens. And the reason it doesn't is that there's no value in telling them the man was black. If they, too, live in a predominantly African-American community and have racially similar friends and family, for the most part, it doesn't help much to tell them to look out for a black man knocking at their door. That's probably going to happen under legitimate circumstances, and repeatedly. We look for, and mention, things that are out of place when we're suspicious. Kanika only mentioned the man at her door, and didn't say he was disguised, so my conclusion is that he was an African-American male, similar in age to her, and offering a relatively clean-cut appearance that wouldn't draw more attention. So, I would say he didn't have facial hair, tattoos on his face, or anything similar. He would be hygienic enough in appearance to not disqualify him as an FBI agent. Now, we're going to find that we have a very strong suspect who looks exactly like that. Of course, as unprofessional as this is to begin with, meaning you don't try to engage and manipulate somebody during a hit, it's going to get far worse. Like I said, when the first guy leaves the apartment and walks away, another male voice from a person hiding calls out to him to go the other way. Obviously, the first idiot is walking in the direction from which he came, which is likely going to lead to a parked vehicle that drove him here. The guy talking from the bushes is trying to prevent that from happening because he knows she's going to call the cops and tell them which direction he went. If there's a cop in the immediate area, he or she might even arrive to circle the neighborhood before they're gone. But the most important thing to realize is that these two are both idiots. The guy walking toward the car is compromising the location of his getaway vehicle, and the guy in the bushes, trying to remedy that, is actually making it worse because he's telling the potential victim there's a conspiracy at play that requires him to hide outside. Had the second guy kept his mouth shut, Kaneko wouldn't know it's a conspiracy. But now she knows two men are involved. Yet what she fails to understand is that neither of those men are aware she heard the presence of the second guy. There's a huge difference. Now, I think plenty of ladies would have said, "I'm out. I'm not staying here tonight. It doesn't matter where I go, but I have to leave." Except Kaneko served in the army, and I'm sure it wasn't because she gets scared and runs at the first sign of adversity. So, despite the fact she exclaims in her email that she got no sleep at all during the weekend, with "no" in capital letters, she's decided to hold the fort because, while there's sufficient danger to be concerned, there hasn't been an attack. So Kaneko isn't going to retreat in any way. She forms a thought process conducive to continuing to hold the fort, but doing so while adapting to the new dangers. Accordingly, she says she's going to get an alarm system installed in the home, and also going to alert her allies, meaning friends and family, of the lurking dangers. But the folly in this is that it's very much consistent with a military mindset, which makes the apartment a base with strategic value worth defending to the death. Yet, the conspiracy is not one created to acquire the base, aka apartment. It's to kill the person and to acquire any valuable resources inside. It's a domestic endeavor, and therefore calls for domestic solutions related to the individual in question, rather than teamwork. Kaneko is acting as though the apartment and her circle of family and friends come before she does, which is very honorable, but also useless in a domestic circumstance related to crime against an individual. No security system inside the apartment is going to protect her when she walks out the door, or even when she comes back. To further prove this point, check out what she decides to do after they show up again. A man comes to her door a few days later, a different man we could probably assume is the one who was hiding in the bushes the first time around. We don't know, but it might be a safe assumption. It's 7:30 a.m., well before package services generally deliver, and he says he has a package for Kaneko Powell. Yet there's no package in his hands. Of course, she's going to refuse this man's advances as well, and he disappears, never returning after claiming he's going back to the truck to get the package. Now, again, this happens at 7:30 a.m. on a weekday, which means she's about to go to work. But what does she do instead that gets her killed? She indulges that military mindset once again, for all the wrong reasons, and falls right into the trap. Again, I'm certainly not blaming her for these actions, I'm just pointing out how they assisted the killer's faulty logic. So this guy leaves. He knows she's onto him, but now she's scared, and she has to travel out of town in a couple of days, so she decides to take the day off from work, specifically electing to run her errands during the day, instead of later that night, because it's safer and she won't need to go out again when it's dark. That information was relayed to her mother that day. But it will be a fatal decision. So here's my point about her thought process. The two men, or at least two men, have now made two attempts, by different means, to enter the apartment. Each time it happened during daylight hours, the first time at 7 p.m., and the second time at 7:30 a.m. Just think of how stupid these people would have to be to return after striking out the first time. It's high risk to begin with to have so many people out on warm summer nights able to witness you. But if you consider that the police were called last time, the risk is even higher now. They'd have to be desperate. A government assassin, no matter his or her level of experience, would at least be intelligent enough to not make themselves known with fake identities on two occasions. If it's just a hit, you don't need meetings or introductions of any kind. You don't need to get her to open the door. You have enough resources to be able to track her to other locations where it will be dark, she's alone, and not many people are around. If all you know is her name and address, however, you have no choice but to keep coming back to her apartment door. It's obvious they don't want to shoot her in the parking lot and be witnessed pulling the trigger. Now, we know from Kanika's email she hasn't been sleeping well at night, and specifically because of the first incident where the man claimed to be an FBI agent. Since she's losing sleep at night and also planning to do errands during the day, rather than at night after work, it's reasonable to say she thinks there's a strong possibility she's going to get attacked at night. So if she can get home safely, locking herself inside the base, so to speak, she can fend off an attack. But that logic isn't going to work in a domestic situation. In terms of military strategy, it's best to attack a fixed position like a base containing enemy soldiers at night because many of them will be sleeping and/or unprepared, giving the other side a very big advantage. In addition, attacking at night limits the enemy's ability to assess your intentions and strategy due to the lack of visibility. On the day she's killed, Kanika's planning for a potential attack on the base at night. But she's only thinking of it in that context, meaning the enemy coming to her door to attack the base while she's inside, because the first two attempts were like that. They knocked on the door. It hasn't crossed her mind that the enemy will attack her on her way back to the base. I'm not really sure why that is. She's making a correlation between daylight and safety, and also between nighttime and the potential for an attack. Accordingly, she makes an alarm system for the apartment a priority over any type of immediate personal security, from vacating the place to buying a gun, and is left helpless to defend herself when she arrives home at 11:50 a.m. Kanika is shot in the hallway outside her apartment and dies the next day, precluding a bright future for reasons we can't understand. In the meantime, she was in a physical state where she was unable to offer any leads. We're told the man who shot her was the same man who tried to deliver the package earlier in the day, but we haven't been enlightened as to how the cops know that. So, her death remains a mystery, but we learn quite a bit about the attackers. The men are desperate and possess insufficient intellectual qualities to outsmart Kanika. I mean, as much as she walked right into it at the end, it's hard to shut down your life because of threats. You don't want other people to be able to control you because it's wrong, not only criminally but morally as well. I generally see her actions as defiant. She's not going to let these creeps run her life. Now, waiting outside her door on the third attempt is incredibly risky. It's not like they would know when she was going to return home, so they had to spend a significant amount of time in that hallway trying to not be detected. Again, this is not something a trained assassin does. He wouldn't wait in hopes of eventually catching his prey by default of knowing she'll ultimately return, putting himself at great risk of detection or even arrest in the meantime. In fact, the only sign of sophistication present in the crime is the ability to get Kanika's name and address. Both attempts to get in her apartment were laughable. A fake badge? No ID? Not even a name from the supposed FBI agent? And then they try with a package delivery, in which the supposed driver is not even holding any package to deliver? That's not only totally audacious, but presumptive to an extent there's no self-awareness involved. You can't just tell an intelligent person that you're an FBI agent or a package delivery guy. That's a base-level strategy that needs some serious upgrading and refining. It desperately says one thing to me. Open your door. The guy is planning to enter, hold her at gunpoint, and alert the other guy to approach by text or hand signal from a window. The other guy will enter the apartment and lock the door behind him. Now, I don't know their MO once inside, but the results tell me they're planning to kill her. I'm guessing rape and robbery were on the agenda, in addition to an inevitable death to follow. If she's female, in her 20s, lives alone, and has gainful employment, it makes her a likely target. Now, I don't think the plan changed on the third visit, though I do think the perpetrators were angry by this point at their failure. Rather than trying to get her to open the door, they were going to make an even more brazen move by having one of the guys grab her in the hallway on her way back in the door. That way you don't have to rely on her having the proper motivation to unlock the door for you from the other side. But what we learn is that a neighbor reported hearing a woman scream. So what I think happened here is the guy intended to quietly coax her into her apartment without making a sound, likely by surprising her at gunpoint. Unfortunately, that's a very high-risk proposition. She might freeze and stay silent at gunpoint, or she might end up screaming. And the latter of those choices is what happens. The guy gambled, and he lost. Now, he can't take her into the apartment because the cops are definitely getting called, and he can't just run because she can identify him, and she can also call the cops faster than anyone else with her cell phone. So the guy doesn't have a choice. It's a failure. He has to run and hope he gets away, or he can kill her and buy himself a few more minutes. He's angry about this, so he shoots her multiple times in the chest and abdomen. He doesn't even have the awareness to shoot her in the head. And she lives. Only for a day. But that could have amounted to a miracle. So, this is no professional. Terrible, repetitive strategy born of low intelligence and low self-awareness suggests the involvement of a sociopath, if not more than one. While a hitman-for-hire situation is certainly possible, I don't see it occurring here. This event could have been a lot simpler and more efficient than how it was carried out. And you know how the saying goes, you get what you pay for. That's what I see here. This isn't a contracted kill. It's a low-rent criminal enterprise. They wanted access to both Kanika and her apartment. There was no attempt to break and enter in her absence, despite the fact the place had no security system installed, and there was also no attempt to kill her away from the apartment door. It tells me Kanika and her apartment, meaning its contents, were targets. They could have carjacked her, forced her to drive to a remote location, and then raped and killed her before taking the contents of her purse, including cash and credit cards. But there's not even an attempt like that. Her apartment figures into the equation each time, specifically getting inside it. So I don't think this was any type of contracted hit by the government. On the other hand, I believe a personal vendetta is also a decent possibility. Somebody without the resources to hire a decent hitman could have easily hired two bumbling idiots to take care of the job. Now, there's only one consideration that makes me pause on this possibility and truly analyze it as potentially authentic, which is the fact the killer or killers obviously knew that when Kanika left home in the morning in her car on the day of the murder, that she wasn't going to work. If they knew she was going to work, they wouldn't have been waiting outside her door prior to noon. On the other hand, she might have been watched, and having left at an odd time and in clothes she wouldn't normally wear to work, it's possible the killers realized she had the day off. I'd lean in that direction. It's fairly obvious Kanika has no idea who would want to hurt her and didn't so much as make an insinuation it might have anything to do with her job. She seems genuinely confused. So, if somebody is looking to get revenge on her or to push her aside, whether in the context of a promotion at work or a romantic partner, she might have expressed that to her mother because the two of them were so close. But we don't have anything to assert Kanika believed they were known enemies. To the contrary, she tells other people to look out, as though they might be in jeopardy as part of random attacks. That frame of mind suggests she didn't have reason to believe she was targeted and was inclined to think it's random. The whole knew-too-much government conspiracy thing is a little over the top. If it went down like that, it would look like that. And it doesn't. Not in my opinion. The type of crime we're talking about, within the parameters of detection, doesn't keep you free very long. These aren't silent government assassins. They're criminals who end up going to prison because they make a lot of really brazen, audacious moves that will ultimately expose them over time if repeated enough. With that said, I don't want to easily dismiss the notion of a romantic or work competitor hiring a hitman, so I'll bring up another interesting point. The desperation of the killer to get the job done coincides with the days leading up to Kanika's business trip. As her trip gets closer, the killer takes greater measures to get the job done. Even though it isn't safe to come back after the first and second failed attempts, they do so anyway, and in a period of just a few days. Is the desperation due to the window of time closing on Kanika's upcoming trip? Does somebody need to stop her from getting where she's going? Or perhaps interfere with what she's taking in the ignorance of others? Kanika was apparently some sort of chaperone for materials related to classified projects. So is it possible she was standing in the way of somebody? Or inadvertently causing someone trouble? Sure, but we don't have evidence of that. What we do have is two men at her doorstep who don't seem to be her equals on an intellectual level. They get thwarted by her street smarts and finally have to attack her in the hallway. I could think of numerous ways to manipulate this situation for the purposes of success if you put me in the shoes of the perpetrators. Yet, the best this idiot could do was come to her door with no ID or name, claiming to be an FBI agent. You're preying upon the insecurities of people who will become afraid and act, rather than think first and make the safe decision. Kanika doesn't fit that profile. At all. If you served in the military, where rank is incredibly important in understanding how to deal with a subordinate, superior, or even a peer, one of the first things you're going to be inclined to consider in civilian life when some strange person comes to your door claiming to be an authority over you is the validity of that statement. She's being given orders. Accordingly, Kaniga's not answering the door. She's asking for documentation, a warrant, ID, something that legitimizes this person as who he claims to be. Rank is earned, and so when you come to the door flashing a fake badge, somebody like this is going to ask you for those credentials. When someone outsmarts you, the evolutionary principle that breeds success is adaptation. So for instance, if you're a team playing in the Super Bowl and you take a beating from the other team in the first half, you go into the locker room at halftime, discuss your mistakes, draw up plans to do things differently, and then go out in the second half implementing those changes for the sake of winning. But if you're insane, even just to the extent your sociopathic mental illness causes you to engage repetitive behaviors prone to colossal failure, you go back out on the field in the second half and do exactly the same thing to get the same result. Losing. Kanika wasn't fooled by the FBI agent. Why on earth would she open the door for a package delivery man with no package at a time when those services don't even deliver yet, after she'd already been scared to death from the first incident? It's the same strategy. Pretend, but don't prove. That's not going to get her to open the door. Who says, "I have a package for you," and doesn't actually have a package? How fucking hard would it be to fold the lid closed on an empty box and bring it with you? That's how stupid they are. Plus, she can see outside. It's not like a UPS truck or FedEx truck would have been there. But these people are sociopaths. They cannot stray from that faulty pattern of logic when engaging criminality. Now, Kanika never falls for anything. She doesn't get persuaded. She gets ambushed, and the perpetrators don't get what they want. They wanted to get in the apartment. They settled for killing her. That's how they wanted it to end, not start. But she simply would not relent on refusing to allow them into her home. If I examine the number one reason why they were so ignorant of how stupid they were, and just how risky this killing was, it reveals something already apparent in the fact we're dealing with sociopaths. And that's the idea they don't realize how scared Kanika is due to this first incident. I mean, she called the cops, alerted friends and family, didn't sleep, called the FBI to confirm the agent wasn't legit, talked to her mother, etc. A lot of people knew how concerned she was, and if the circumstances had been slightly different, she might have gone out and purchased additional security equipment, like cameras. Or, she might have had someone come stay with her. This person was scared to the point she was convinced to buy a new security system. Meanwhile, the perpetrators are like, "You know, I think 3 days is long enough to wait. It'll blow over by then. And this time, we'll pretend to be delivering a package while not even holding one." That inability to be self-aware enough to realize your strategy has scared the living shit out of the prospective victim and requires modification is born of sociopathy. You just have to not care at all, especially about the risk. A hitman doesn't have the luxury of thinking like a sociopath. You must predict the victim's moves and counteract them accordingly. Setting someone up means rigging the cards in your favor, so to speak, but these idiots are rolling the dice like they're in a casino, gambling on their entry into Kanika's apartment instead of guaranteeing it through sound logic. With that said, it also means the dominant party in this criminal faction, whether it consists of just these two people or more, is the sociopath in question creating the strategy. given that the guy outside the apartment on the visit by the fake FBI agent instructed the fake agent on which way to go, I have to believe he's in charge and also believe his logic was responsible for birthing both frauds. Let's take notice that when the first guy tries to get inside the apartment, the fake FBI agent, he has no answer when asked for his name or his identification. Had this been his idea, he likely would have covered those bases, but instead he doesn't even attempt to lie. The second guy, however, the package handler, immediately says the package that's not in his hands is actually outside in his truck, and then takes off under the guise of going to get it, only to leave. This guy, as opposed to the first, has a plan B for making his way out of there when she calls him out on his bullshit. Given that the first guy acted like a parrot for the second guy's logic, he had no answers when questioned beyond what he was told to say. Therefore, while the package guy buys a few minutes to escape by pretending to go to the truck, the FBI agent walks away disbelieved entirely and is spotted taking directions from someone else because he's not up to this task. All of this takes place in daylight. Picture yourself standing outside Kanika's apartment building, discreetly trying to tell your bumbling cohort to walk the opposite direction and doing it in a manner the potential victim could hear you. This is something you plan beforehand. Like, hey, go this roundabout way to get to the car so she doesn't see where you go. It's not hard, but it is for these guys. Now, there's no way to know exactly who committed this crime, as we have no physical evidence to support a theory or even specific circumstantial evidence. On the other hand, we have a strong profile of the killers. Let's try to get a match. In all honesty, I think the perpetrator of this crime is the infamous mother-daughter killer, Jason Thomas Scott. He's a shameless sociopath, a former leader of a criminal organization that sold illegal weapons, committed burglaries, and perpetrated armed home invasions in the area where Kanika lived during that time. Scott worked for UPS and utilized the company's database to choose victims based on various factors. He would then stalk them, observing them to learn specific details about their lives. That's when he'd make a move. Sometimes it was a carjacking to get the car, other times a home invasion to collect valuables. But the one thing we know about Jason Thomas Scott is that he was ultimately responsible for more than 50 burglaries, 9 of which were confirmed as armed home invasions. One of those incidents included the sexual assault of a minor, an activity he documented with his phone, and another rendered 2 murdered women, both of whom were African American. Jason Thomas Scott is also African American and similar in age to Kanika, being 2 years younger. With my assessment that the perpetrator wanted both Kanika herself and access to the apartment for the purposes of sexual assault and robbery, Scott fits the profile. Now, he's in prison doing 100 years already, so I don't think this case is going anywhere soon, unfortunately. But let's consider this. The killer's movements, like I said earlier, are incredibly audacious. It's like he's not concerned about the cops showing up and catching him, or even identifying him. Well, the one thing that made Jason Thomas Scott very successful over the short term is that he would operate with a police scanner, using an earpiece to listen for any activity while committing his crimes. If the cops got called, he'd hook off. Though Scott was an illegal arms dealer and made numerous sales from the guns he stole, he also managed to sell 15 guns to undercover agents investigating him. Needless to say, this guy is no criminal mastermind. He's a sociopath, and it's pretty clear doing things like selling guns out of the UPS facility parking lot is stupid. In fact, it's the same type of stupidity prevalent with Kanika's murder. He sold guns to agents on numerous occasions. Because he was someone who was unable to identify these were agents with his intellectual prowess, he was also incapable of posing himself as an agent when the time came, and for the same reason. He just wasn't smart enough. Jason Thomas Scott was apprehended quickly, and for dozens of crimes so blatantly and obviously committed by him, that he and his attorney reportedly slipped the cops a list of 40 homes he burglarized, 9 by gunpoint, without hesitation. Again, he's doing 100 years. He volunteered his guilt to that result, rather than fighting it, so you can imagine how much worse his crimes really were, in terms of quantity and aggression. If you ask me, he's very likely the culprit in this case, having been assisted by at least one other member of the small group of criminals he led. He couldn't have what he wanted, so in the end he settled for taking Kaniga's life. That was control. Control is the theme present in Scott's crimes. Carjacking, stalking, robbery at gunpoint. And beyond that, Scott was even known to steal electronics, like TVs and phones, during these burglaries. So, Kaniga would have been a nice fit. She's single, lives alone, and has a good job that would afford her things like a nice TV and a phone. Now, I have no direct evidence of Scott's guilt, but he fits the profile, was active at the time in the immediate area, and there's nothing to indicate this pattern of crime continued after Kaniga died and he went to prison. Given that the first man to approach Kanika's door was being managed by the second, evidenced by the explicit directions to walk a different way outside, we have to assume the second guy was the one in control. It says, if you want something done right, you gotta do it yourself. So we know someone else takes the reins on the next visit to the door, this time posing as a package delivery guy. Now, what do we know about Jason Thomas Scott? He was in charge of everybody. He was the leader of the criminal group. So when the first attempt fails, and the guy who was managing it steps up to try, what does he pose as? Somebody delivering a package. And what did Jason Thomas Scott do while committing these crimes? He worked at UPS. And what time did this supposed package delivery take place? 7:30 a.m., when Jason knows UPS wouldn't have delivered to that location yet on that specific day. So for me, this puzzle piece fits. In terms of the psychology, I think Jason Thomas Scott was a low-rent sociopath paving his way toward a lifetime sentence with one audacious criminal act after another. These crimes happened in a short window of time, something typical for sociopaths. They ramp up their crimes at a rate that couldn't land them anywhere except prison or the grave. But either way, the idea is to not ever have to grow up, be a man, and abide the laws of society. This guy stole from civilians and also from gun manufacturers and importers. Picture yourself stealing numerous firearms from a federal licensee that answers to the ATF. If you take this shit, the ATF is going to look for you. Does that sound like a good idea for the leader of a criminal enterprise that's so much like a preteen clubhouse that they have a home called the Spooky House where they go and divide their loot after crimes? When you do something this stupid, what happens is you end up selling the guns back to the agents looking for you. Because you're a sociopath. You can't see it's an awful idea, alter your strategy, or even reconsider. Sociopaths go full steam ahead like nothing could go wrong. Accordingly, Scott, who's looking at 100 years in prison, doesn't make any attempt to get out of this. His lawyer obviously decided a not guilty plea would be laughable, and only at that point does Scott realize just how strong the evidence against him really is. Sadly, if he is guilty of killing Kaniga Powell, the fact she thwarted his efforts to enter her apartment likely precluded the presence of available physical evidence. As opposed to the other crimes, where he definitively entered the home and assaulted people or murdered them, Kanika's case offers no witnesses, DNA, etc. So, in totality, what I see here is not an assassination to silence someone, but a botched home invasion specifically involving a conspiracy of two or more men constituting a small-time criminal organization and intended for the purpose of robbery and sexual assault. Kaniga was single, lived alone, and was similar in age and race to Jason Scott. If he knew she was a military vet, he might have also suspected she was a gun owner from whom he could steal. Now, the last thing I want to talk about regarding the actual crime scene is that Kanika's wallet and keys were lying next to her, so police suggest the motive wasn't robbery. Let me correct them. Yes, it was. It was one of the motives. If Kaniga screams upon seeing the shooter, foiling his plan to try to keep her silent by threat of the gun, and then he forces his way into the apartment, he has to bypass the entire process of the home invasion, robbery, sexual assault, etc. He has to go straight to the killing because the scream will attract attention and the police will be called. He can't have her as a witness, and he's angry she ruined his plans three times over. So if it's three strikes and you're out, this was it for her. If he desired a home invasion leading to sexual assault and theft, indulging the control like a drug, as Jason Thomas Scott did while documenting himself assaulting a minor during another home invasion? The scream made it impossible. So he kills her, and the best way to leave the scene at that point is definitely without her wallet and keys. Driving her car is a really bad idea, and having her wallet in your possession is a damning piece of evidence. You can do this if you leave a crime scene where the victims are dead and you haven't been detected by outsiders, but in this circumstance, Kaniga has already screamed and been heard. Plus, if you're selling automatic weapons on the black market, you don't need $100 out of someone's wallet. This isn't a stick-up by a drug addict. It's about control, from a sociopath. And once Kanika's dead, the cash in her wallet won't offer you control. The only move is to shoot her and leave immediately. That gives him control of her life in the absence of anything else, along with eliminating a primary witness. It's a dual purpose of emotional fulfillment and practicality in avoiding detection. If the perpetrator is wearing an earpiece broadcasting the police scanner, then he's aware of the response to this incident and also whether or not the police are pursuing him. It gives him a few minutes to get away. As for witnesses at the apartment building, or even out on the street, I'm guessing the police do have eyewitness sightings, but perhaps not enough to substantiate a good rendering from a sketch artist that would be worth revealing to the public. I'm not sure. So, we don't know who pulled the trigger in this case, but my money is on Jason Thomas Scott. I think he and his attorney gave the cops as much as they needed to put him away for life, and the rest of his terrible crimes remained buried, literally and figuratively. It's not uncommon for killers to withhold knowledge of specific crimes. I think what's likely is that there was no way for police to prove Scott killed Kanika Powell, so he and or his attorney neglected to even mention it. A closer look at Scott's victims reveals he targeted attractive, financially secure African-American women for the purpose of home invasion, sexual assault, and murder by handgun. Like Kanika's case, one of his other young female victims didn't die from the gunshots immediately either. He neglected to shoot her in the head, and she was able to live long enough to call 911 and report the incident. And if you really want to understand the colossal stupidity afforded by a sociopathic mindset, just consider that Scott was actually quite intelligent and even handsome by some accounts, a college graduate who was also pursuing a master's degree. But where did he learn about forensics and avoiding detection? On fictional TV shows. This guy is in the process of getting a master's degree and doesn't realize the most likely buyers for stolen automatic weapons are going to be cops investigating the theft in which they were acquired. That's what sociopathy does to the brain. It creates a rigid pattern of logic from which you can't free yourself, one angered in desire that leads from the start of antisocial behavior across the spectrum to violent criminality, ending in prison or death. There's also a potential connection to a case nearby at that time in which a man named Sean Green was shot to death. But while there are some similarities, there's no definitive connection between the two cases. They could be related. We don't know. But I believe the perpetrators of this crime leave us enough clues to profile them. And that conclusion, for me, is that Jason Thomas Scott and his crew are guilty. With that said, it could have been anybody. Unfortunately, we might never know. So, to close this out, I want to focus on something we can answer. Who was Kanika Powell? Why did she stay when she could have abandoned ship? And I think, as outsiders, what's easiest to see is that her pursuits in adult life were selfless. And despite her propensity for being alone, she was a great team player. She made sacrifices by serving overseas in the army and came home to extend her service to her country, even just ceremoniously, by finding employment related to national security projects. When the fake FBI agent came to her door, she was concerned with alerting other women she knew about the danger in the area, rather than just thinking of her own safety and comfort. But why did she hold the fort when she could have taken off? Strangely, I found that answer in something her mother revealed after death. Kanika was an organ donor, and according to her mother, she was able to help people in need. It's so honorable. But did she have to die, I ask myself. Couldn't she just have said to herself, it's okay to be afraid, and go stay somewhere else tonight? Or even that whole week? And it hits me that I've always been registered as an organ donor, too. So maybe the reason Kanika remained in harm's way, when she could have taken flight, is within that experience somewhere. Now, back in college, before I failed out, of course, there was an older fraternity brother of mine who still lived in that town and was finishing the requirements for a degree at age 27 after entering college right out of high school. What happened is that one day they had a game of tackle football going on out in the yard, and he was this big, strong guy who collided with another guy, causing a freak accident. Unfortunately, he was badly injured afterward, and in a manner that makes it difficult for me to explain the process without any type of medical expertise. So, for lack of a better way to say it, the injury caused the poisoning of numerous organs, which then began to fail, leaving him in need of what was a very experimental and groundbreaking surgery at the time, one in which he had 5 organs replaced, if I remember correctly. Now, obviously, something like that takes a tremendous toll on the body, so although he was 27, he looked about 63, and moved like he was 10 years older. He was bitter, wise well beyond his years. But I remember when the end was coming close for him. You could see he was getting thinner and pale, a bit less bite in his bark all the time. Now, I was around at the beginning of that stage. I remember it happening. I had just failed out of school and came back the next semester to hang out anyway. I said I was going to work, but refused to do a lot of the terrible jobs available at the time. I was broke and floundering, making excuses about everything. And during a conversation with this guy, as I was expressing my misery with repetitive use of the phrases, I can't and I don't want to, I could see him growing tired of me. Suddenly, he slams his hand down on the table, leans toward me with his teeth gritted, and says, you fucking do what you gotta do. And I was silent. I was looking into the face of death and complaining about how much it hurt to live. He died months later, and I'm still here today. But I had a few moments in life when I was afraid, when I didn't want to face reality about who I was, or what I had become, or whether my life meant anything at all. Yet no matter the hardship, I've always remembered those words. However, it isn't until recently that it dawned on me that he was scared to die, and I was scared to live. But in the face of that death, he tried to protect me from a life that didn't mean anything. Because that's truly the worst demise any one of us could possibly ever know. So every time I feel like I don't have the courage to do something, I remember those words. You fucking do what you gotta do. You stand up for what's right. And no matter the result, I think Kaniko Powell did the same. She believed this was her home, and she was going to defend it, just like she swore to do for her country during her service in the army, despite the dangers. I mean, if you examine the core principle at stake here, it's clear that Kaniko refused to stand down in the face of imminent danger, because it was going to inhibit her freedom. That's what this was about. Freedom, security, and always facing your fears. Her adherence to those ideals speaks of great courage. Kanika chose to stay, not because it was the smart thing to do, but because running leads to more running. often there's nowhere to hide in life. So it's easy to admire people who never try. Sometimes there's a price to pay for that. But humans who live this way never die asking the meaning of existence. They always knew and were never left to wonder what their purpose might have been. I believe Kanika was one of them. So between now and the arrival of our own fate, whatever that might be, and whenever it shall come, may we stand tall in the face of death, and finally, be free.